Hi there. You're listening to Sample Space. It is a podcast about machine learnings, but moreover, the ideas in the ecosystem that tend to go overlooked. In this episode, we're going to talk about the fact that when you're dealing with a machine learning use case, that more often than not, you are dealing with not one data set, but usually many. Either you have some CSV files or some tables somewhere that need to be joined together in interesting ways in order for the machine learning pipeline to make sense. And this is where tons of interesting problems tend to arise. How can you make sure that the datasets can be joined correctly? And also, can we even find the datasets that are interesting for our machine learning pipelines? I'll be talking to Madelon Hulsebos about this topic, partially because she has a PhD in this topic. We don't get too much into the nitty-gritty details of math, though, but we do discuss the larger problem that we do have. Most of all, because I do think it tends to be overlooked that we're usually dealing with many tables instead of just a single one. I hope you really enjoy it. So, all right. Hello, Madelon.
Hey, Vincent. Good to be here.
Hi, hi. You know, we were talking in Dutch before. We're going to totally do that in English now, but I will call you Madelon and not Madelon, I suppose. But anyway, Madelon, like the reason why we're going to be talking today is because I think you're doing interesting work. Like, there's not a whole lot of researchers that make the astute observation that usually you're not dealing with one CSV file when you're doing stuff with data. Usually you're dealing with like many of them. So that's a very interesting field, I would say. But before getting there, like, I always try to figure out what led someone to do a particular kind of work. And we were talking beforehand. And one thing that I thought was interesting is that you dipped your toes a little bit in industry before moving to academia and sort of like studying this topic. And part of me is just kind of curious on that story before we dive into the nitty gritty of your sort of research work. So just as the like Marvel origin story, like how did we get here?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually to that, it all started with even a tinier bit of research actually. At MIT, and just to very briefly explain what I was doing there, straight after my master's, I wasn't really sure what to do. And then I did this research project at the MIT Media Lab. And it was a very fun project that I did there that was actually on, you know, table understanding for visualization recommendation. And it was super cool. And, you know, I can talk about more on the content there. But just purely in the context of, you know, industry versus research, I thought after that research project, like, oh, I have this paper now. Now what? So I really felt that it was kind of sad to not see the actual use of it. So then I turned to industry, and it was really fun to really work on actually building stuff. And it all slightly related to the research that I have been doing, because in industry I was building, you know, tools to kind of abstract away code from data analysis. So I was just building some kind of interface to do data prep and data analysis and so on for other data scientists to work with.
So and around what time was this? So you were at MIT before, this was right after your master's, this was like how many years ago?
2018, 2019,
okay.
Yeah.
Ish, okay. And so well before COVID. And then after that for a bit, you went into industry, and then you still had like your tools in your back pocket, you know, doing stuff with tables and visualization, but then you kind of became more of a tool maker for your colleagues, I suppose. That's kind of what I'm hearing then.
Exactly. Yeah, that was what I was doing there. And it was super fascinating to kind of abstract away the tedious operations that people do over tables, indeed CSV files.
And what kind of operation would be tedious in that sense?
This was really focused. So I was actually a data scientist, so I was supposed to build models. Mm-hmm. But instead, I was building like data validation pipelines. So maybe you know the tool Great Expectations. Mm-hmm. And I was really building like these data validation pipelines to kind of give feedback to other data scientists about the quality of their data that they were working with. And then on top of that, you know, some data preparation steps followed that were also abstracted away. Before, you know, more insights were generated as well automatically. So
I'm going to attempt an example. You can correct me if I'm overstretching it, but I can imagine things like, oh, we have a client who has web logs and they want to add sessions. And, oh, hang on, there's a user here with a million sessions in an hour. That feels weird. maybe filter that out. And you would make these expectation lists of your data set, check for like these sorts of things, and then like interact with your sort of more modeling colleagues, like, hey, maybe not do fit predict on this just yet. Kind of like that. This is kind of the vibe and the feeling that we're talking about, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And there are so many. I was basically looking into data quality and data validation rules and trying to standardize that for given data sets. So I was back then, I was really focused on marketing analysis. So we had we knew what kind of data was coming in, but we weren't sure of the quality of it because there were so many errors in the data that was coming in. And we had tools that many data scientists used, but they were not familiar with like data validation back then. It was 2019, so that was less of a popular and concept, right?
So the data centric hype thing happened a bit after that, I think. But I do think that's interesting because as I remember, you were definitely in the early era of data quality is super important. But was this something that came out of yourself? Like you were looking at the data and going like, hang on, folks, we shouldn't do anything with this? Or were you also kind of in a team that was looking to invest in this?
Oh, phew. Well, to be very honest, I don't remember.
Okay.
I think...
Because the reason I'm asking is this whole data quality attitude doesn't come naturally to everyone. That's something I've noticed over the years. Like there seems to be a certain kind of person who really prefers to go into the rabbit hole of modeling. And it does take a slightly different kind of approach to also be able to take a step back. But it seems like you were able to do that quite early.
Yeah, but that is mainly arising from being in a very interesting phase of data, being a data scientist still, because I was a very end-to-end data scientist.
Right.
I was talking a lot with users.
Yeah.
And I was talking with product owners and the whole end-to-end thing. And I think there it became really clear from the people that I was building this tool for that, these data errors were important. And to be honest, there was there were two data engineers that were also fascinated with this. So I think, so we teamed up and we got this kind of interest in this, and then we kind of integrated this into the tool.
Yeah, it definitely helps if you have the right perspective. I have talked to people who were hired as a data scientist, and then manager says, right, you go into a basement, do fit predict to your notebook, and after 2 months, come out. And I can definitely imagine if you were able to have a more holistic view, that you also have a more holistic attitude of where the problem is. And yeah, with that perspective, data quality comes a bit quicker, I think.
Exactly, yeah. And that's actually exactly the reason that I turned to back to research. Well, one of the two reasons, actually, because around 2020, I think, this end-to-end data scientist role became way more, how do you say that, distributed across specialized roles. So then you had a machine learning engineer, you had all kinds of roles pop up, and that's great. But I really like this kind of end-to-end, persona that I was. I was working with so many different people. I was really also kind of free writing a little bit, which was not always fun for the data engineers, especially the lead data engineers, because I was using tools such as Streamlit, right? And they were no, we shouldn't be using Streamlit. It's really not robust, not mature. So I guess that made the data scientist role less fun for me, because I like to kind of dive into new problems, figure out new ways to approach it instead of doing the same trick over and over again and heavily optimizing
one specific
component in a data science pipeline.
I can definitely imagine that there's areas of industry where the attitude can kind of be, oh, we understand the trick very well. Well, we've done our exploring. Let's now exploit. And I'm paraphrasing a bit here. It's not really like that. But I can also imagine if you're interested in sort of broadening your horizon, that's not always possible in industry. That is definitely true, because sometimes if you find a good trick, the main thing industry needs to do is make sure it's applied. That is still pretty interesting though, because I can also definitely imagine that we're going to talk about table representations in a bit, but I can also imagine how data quality is kind of a really nice introduction to that field as well. A recurring theme in this entire podcast is, okay, how did person X end up doing thing Y? And part of me is wondering how it all might have been different if you hadn't had that industry experience. Like, I can also imagine that the industry experience really helped ground you in the direction you wanted to take your academic work.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And it's funny because at MIT, I had done this like more narrow research project, basically predicting the type of a column, the semantic type of a column. So you can imagine you have a table and you have, you know, names, addresses, and so on. And you want to kind of have like a standardized type per column.
Right. So not just string, integer, or float, no address, like a bit more specific.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And you know, it's wild to see how people have different ways to add a column name that shoots like express addresses, right? So that's very not standardized. And the goal there was to have a standard semantic type. Because if you have that, if you have these standard types, if you can predict it from the table that you have, then the idea was that you would also be able to, you know, recommend visualizations that are suitable for given table columns. So you can imagine that if you have, you know, some geographic column like countries, as well as an income column, then you can predict to visualize the incomes distributed over a map, for example.
Ah, yeah, and also like you have an XY coordinate. No, it's latitude, longitude, and therefore we don't use matplotlib. You use something like a map instead. And yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is the kind of use case that was driving that, and then I had this kind of need to see things in real life, and then indeed, as you said, you know, you were working on data quality and data preparation and building like automated workflow like tools on top of that basically, and then I was kind of connecting the dots there because I felt, oh, wait, we're doing all these kind of operations over tables. And I'm doing this now for this retailer, but I know, you know, that other people, other data scientists will do exactly the same task over roughly the same data. So why wouldn't we kind of generalize this and indeed do something with representation learning and now, you know, generative models, of course, for structured data? Because there are so many, you know, patterns in, you know, how we use this data and what we do with it. So that was kind of what inspired me, let's say, to do a PhD in that direction and also turn back to research, because I think it was the perfect timing. And this was in 2021. It was the perfect timing to also explore that area because we had seen so many like text embeddings and, you know, this was coming up a lot, but no one was really working with tabular data back then, or at least not in this skill, right? So that was super interesting to push that agenda saying, hey, you know, you're all working with text and images, but I've been in industry and I see that all these data scientists are working with actually structured data instead. So that was kind of motivating me to jump into that.
So I want to ask a quick question first, but then I do want to dive into this because I'm always curious for anecdotes because you were talking about like, oh, there are these weird types and things I've seen and I'm not really going to ask for like a horror scenario, but do you remember some sort of anecdote where you kind of went like, oh man, like, that is such a mistake that will totally hit someone in the face, but we need tools to sort of help fix this. We need a better linter for the field. Like, do you remember an anecdote? If you don't, that's totally fine. But I always got to ask.
Yeah. Not necessarily a specific one, because this is, you know, that I was actually working with this kind of data sets and was like stumbled by the errors that I found in there. That's already quite some time ago. So I don't have a very specific example in mind. Just the general conclusion that I was amazed by the variety that you see. And I think perhaps like a pattern there is that we have indeed CSV files and, you know, we dump them in data lakes and so on. But, you know, many people, we have CSV standards for CSV files actually. But people don't really use those, or at least, you know, they really deviate from what is, you know, supposed to be a CSV format.
And are we talking about like the how you represent a date time in a CSV, like on that level or a different axis?
Yeah, but even, you know, putting comments, for example, in the first few rows of a CSV file, way more like Excel-like, right? It's pretending it's like a spreadsheet that you can just dump anything into. So I think that kind of messes up the interaction with CSV files and the kind of standardized workflows that you can build on top of them, because you see these variations a lot.
Right. And this is this like a standardized feature? Because I should rephrase. Because there is an interesting thing there where I believe there's probably some ISO standard for CSV files. There's probably a file with lots of definitions on how CSV could work. But then you also get into the field of, well, but does Pandas actually implement the standard? And if not, does Spark do it? And, oh, are Spark and Pandas maybe different? And you mentioned this the metadata commenting thing. And I remember seeing that like a long time ago. But is that like a thing that's commonly used now? Or is it one of these standards that are like not used at all in your experience?
Well, no. So the thing is that people should not put comments.
You were saying it like that. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. But many people do.
I do remember seeing some CSV files that did that. And I was wondering if this was like some sort of standard I was missing out on. But this is just folks putting in comments and not listening to the standard, basically. That's the...
Yeah, it's just very loosely specified, I think. And, you know... Nothing kind of communicates what is expected from a CSV file, except if you know where these standards are put on, like on the web, then you know roughly what is kind of standard. But yeah, it's you know, even the CSV reader in Pandas, right? It makes these assumptions, but they often don't hold. And this is also this. Yeah, maybe we'll get to it later. But when I was parsing lots of CSV files. This was definitely one of the main challenges. Like, how do we parse CSV files properly to tables?
Oh,
and
man,
the percentage that kind of follows the assumptions and the standards from CSV files is just pretty mediocre. So,
I do have one horror story that I just feel like mentioning to you, because I can imagine it'll make you giggle. I was at a financial institution, let's say, and at some point we were wondering, okay, is there something weird with the formatting? Because this CSV file does not want to be read whatsoever. It was just every single complaint and error we could get in our face, we'd just go ahead and get it. And then it turned out, though, that we were dealing with a transaction, the date of which predates the year zero. So there was just a bug in the data itself. And that ended up resulting in the formatter throwing all sorts of errors. But there you go. Like, this is dynamic data sets all around, and it's definitely a pain to deal with, especially at large orgs. So like, okay, we do have a bit of a similar perspective, I would say, in that sense. But then let's be a bit formal then, because you've mentioned the term data representation learning, and I can definitely imagine like that could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So if you were to describe this field and domain of data table representation learning, like what would be a good definition?
Well, the goal is to use neural networks to extract some kind of representation, like a numeric vector, let's say, from that data that captures the semantics well and can generalize to different tasks.
So the idea is we have some sort of CSV table, some columns, some rows. It in goes into the algorithm and out comes some sort of vector. And similar tables should have similar vectors. Roughly this domain?
Yeah. But you can also think that, you know, you might not only want to have a representation on table level. You know, that might be useful, for example, for retrieving these, you know, over these tables. But you can also imagine that you want to have column representations. So, for example, for this column type prediction task, you need to have column representations. And some of that still takes in the semantics of the entire table, of course. But then you need a vector per column. And yeah, but basically that's the idea. And yeah, that's the original kind of concept of representation learning for tables, and then for columns in tables, for headers in tables, for rows in tables, and even for cells in tables, right? So if you want to do, you know, data cleaning, then you might need to go deeper into a table on cell level.
So, and it's in a slightly similar to the sense that you've got word embeddings and you've got document embeddings, and they both have a role to play and they can play nice together. And there's a similar thing happening here, just that we're dealing with tables.
Exactly.
That's the
actually funny story is that in the first project, well, not necessarily funny, but in the first, very first project that I was working with, we were actually working with word embeddings indeed. And although you can come quite far with that, because quite some tables actually contain text as well, it falls short when you want to do things with, you know, numeric columns, for example, or... So then, you know, this representation doesn't hold well. But it's actually very interesting to see that this very basic model that we built back then in 2019 currently still outperforms like more a generative model like GPT 3.5 for this specific task. So then you can also wonder like, okay, you know, do you always want to go, you know, use GPT for any given task, or does sometimes... You know, this very low capacity model that you can even host privately is very small model, right? You know, sometimes that's sufficient. You can use it.
It's a theme I have learned from my time in natural language processing is that a word list can very easily outperform a very fancy model at times. If you have a word list of all the video games, that is probably a good starting point to detect video games.
It's, I mean, you know what you're working with then. It's pretty reliable and robust. So, sometimes that's okay, but yeah, if you want to do kind of all kinds of crazy things on tables, then you might want to have a generalist model, of course. But
so one thing, I'm just out of curiosity, because I'm wondering, okay, we've got word embeddings; they can do stuff with the column name, and it, you know, feels as a reasonable starting point. But are there known failure scenarios for that? Like one thing I remember from experience is sometimes these columns have abbreviations because a guy called Bob, let's say, archetype, thought it was a good idea to abbreviate those long words. And then that, I can imagine that would be like a failure scenario for the for that approach. Is stuff like this, is that the reason why they might fail sometimes as well? Or
absolutely. So actually, the first model that I was building purely built this column representation, so this column vector, let's say, purely from data values. Because as you said, if you train this model and you take in like the embedding of a column name, then, you know, that might not generalize from like the data that you've trained the model on to a data in your data warehouse. And that's actually a very like interesting discrepancy that we see in this field. So most of the research has been done and evaluated on tables from the web. And so you can imagine, for example, tables from Wikipedia, but that is nothing like the tables that you see in real world databases. So, you know, and that's also why I've been really concerned with building data sets that are representative for offline tables. That's why I'm concerned with, you know, understanding what these models actually do. What do they capture? How do they generalize? Because very often, indeed, you have these abbreviations and then, you know, your fancy model trained on Wikipedia, you know, doesn't make any sense. And that's an interesting example. Yeah, for sure.
A question just out of curiosity as well. So, okay, we can describe the task of coming up with a good embedding for a column. Okay, that feels kind of like a well-defined task, but I can also imagine it sort of depends on what you want to do with that representation later. So one use case I can imagine is, well, here's just a dump of tables. Which columns might we be able to join together? Like, it feels like that could be a reasonable use case. Are there also other use cases, or is that kind of the main one?
So that's definitely another use case where it needs... capturing the semantics on column level makes a lot of sense. You can think of data cleaning, so data imputation, for example. Then you want to also capture some semantics. But generally, these like representation learning models are not trained to perform one task. So they are intended to generalize across tasks. So you can imagine, so then, you know, you can easily perform an operation with the same embedding that's a completely different task. So indeed, like join discovery might use the same kind of column embeddings as semantic column type prediction, for example.
Makes sense. But besides, like what are the main sort of other tasks then? So we've got, we just briefly mentioned the joining, but like what other tasks would you include here?
Yeah, so you have... semantic column type prediction, you have join discovery, you have union discovery, of course, where, you know, you have more...
Yeah, that's a good one.
Row level embeddings, you have, like, data transformations. So how to clean certain columns, for example, or how to, well, we've had joining and unioning. What are other...
I mean, I can also imagine like, hey, is this table an aggregate of the other table and then which columns were aggregated? I can kind of, like, some of that stuff kind of feels like it might be relevant here, but you do get more to table representation at some point than column representation.
Yeah, but that's, I think, still, you know,
it's related.
In the same niche
same
kind of area. But definitely that's relevant. And I'm currently focusing on retrieval cases. So then you can think of retrieval augmented generation. So which table is relevant to answer a certain question? So imagine you're interacting with ChatGPT and you want to ask it questions or like an analysis questions, for example, over your corpus of tables. And then you want to retrieve tables. And then, you know, you might start off with embeddings that capture the semantics of the table before you go down into, okay, I need this like snapshot of columns, rows and columns to feed into the context. So that's another use case of embeddings. But same for dataset search. So if you want to train a machine learning model for churn prediction or something, you know, you might want to find the relevant dataset for that. So then you use data like table embeddings as well.
And again, we kind of get into the sort of inspiring the data scientist area maybe a little bit as well. Like, oh, if you're doing stuff with churn, by the way, we also keep track of these properties that might be relevant here. It kind of sounds like it's, what you're describing here is some of the plumbing that will eventually help you have a more intelligent conversation potentially with a data set. And for that, we need to understand the columns. And we also need to know the idea, like, why is this table here? What does it serve? What does it do, et cetera?
Indeed. Across the whole kind of data analytics pipeline, basically.
Part of me is curious, because do you also talk to, you're in academia, so I can imagine you definitely talk to people from academia, you discuss papers, et cetera, but I would imagine you also incidentally would talk to people from industry, maybe some folks who actually maintain a big data warehouse, and you get to talk about their grievances and such. If you were to, just from the story of practice, like what are the main vibes people do tell you? Because I can imagine, like, every big company I've been to, the data is always a mess. Like, everyone has this pain in a way, right? So I'm curious what sort of stories they might tell you in that sense.
Well, I think what I've seen so far is that this research area has received more and more interest from industry.
Right.
So that's one. So there's a lot of interest in, or people see the potential of, like, building, for example, low or no code tools for data analysis. So there's definitely this interest driven from practice. And I think what is the main insight is that people say, okay, but you have this model and it's all trained on this data from the web, but the data that I'm looking at is completely different.
So yeah. Okay.
The tables are, for example, much larger. There are all these relationships across tables, right? So that's the kind of use case that we should really address. And then, you know, of course, there's a wild variety of applications that people are actually doing that we need to kind of inform ourselves with as well. But generally, I think the kind of get realistic is something that we're getting more and more to in the coming years, probably.
So the reason why I bring this up is because I saw a paper of yours, and it's always a good sign if the title of the paper makes me giggle. And the name of this particular paper was "It Took Longer Than I Was Expecting: Why Dataset Search Is Still So Hard." Nice little jump to this topic, because it feels like this is kind of what we're talking about. So also partially to maybe summarize that article, like, why is dataset still so hard, do you think? Because it feels like we've started getting some tools, but is the truth of the matter maybe that it's also just a very human problem? Like, we're in the end, we are archiving, and all sorts of knowledge gets lost when a colleague leaves. And, like, is that also the truth of the matter?
Well, Mike, from the study that we did this survey need among many, many practitioners, I think around 90, is that these tools are just really behind. So you, and I think this is actually how we connected as well a bit more. You have this one search bar, and then you're expected to express your search need into that search bar. And then, okay, you know, maybe you have a few concepts of that kind of describe the data that you need for your use case. And then, okay, you've expressed that, and then you have a few filters that you can use. But I think the problem, and this touches on the kind of intuition that you had, is that many people don't really know indeed what data they need for a given task. So all these systems that we currently have, all these kind of data set search systems, they assume that people know what data they need to implement or address their question or implement their machine learning model or something. But I think, and that's also what I took from industry myself, and this was basically more my experience as well that resonated with all the kind of practitioners that we surveyed, is that people just don't know what data they have also, but also what data they need for this task. So I think, and that's where we are getting towards now, is to make these search systems more task-driven. So you just have to express what task you want to perform, and then you can find relevant data sets for it. So it also doesn't necessarily have to be one CSV file, for example. It can be more CSV files, because many machine learning pipelines typically use multiple CSV files, for example. So this is, yeah, one of the assumptions that doesn't hold, I think, in practice.
Yeah. So I actually have an anecdote on this one. So I was at this logistical warehouse at some point, and it was really what you described. So like, okay, the task is we have to predict how many people need to be on the ground floor, because we get number of trucks equals like divide that by 12, and then you have the number of people that need to be on the floor or something to help carry stuff into the trucks, etc. And this was one of those warehouses that would close down during off season. And then when they would open up again, the demand would be super high, and we're all sorts, oh God, be different weekends, different parameters. Like modeling that thing was insanely tricky. And then in my last day at that firm, someone told me, oh, by the way, Vincent, have you ever seen the carts table? It's like, the carts table, what's that for? And the guy goes, well, the truck, whenever they come in, they need carts to put stuff in, because you need a cart to put stuff into the truck. And those carts, we actually rent them. So we know like about like a week ahead of time how many carts they're going to come bring back. And I was kind of like, oh, hang on. So if you know how many carts are going to come back, we also know how many trucks are going to come in. So then why on earth are we building this model?
Yeah, I think that's a great example. Yeah,
half a year wasted.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that's exactly what I had encountered as well. Yeah. You know, the number of people I was talking to understand what data I needed for a particular use case was insane. And then with every conversation with a domain expert, you know, that takes a week before, because you need to schedule a meeting, then you need to wait for it. Then, you know, they also don't really know what data they have available. So this kind of unawareness of the data and what data is actually useful, I think that's a big problem in industry. So, and I think, I mean, there is some research on it and there is some development in it, but this is why we really think it's time to kind of revisit this problem, especially now that we have this kind of generative models and embedding models. You know, we can do things a little bit more flexible. We can, you know, really improve this, I think.
It makes a lot of sense. And like, I so remember when I was, you know, a consultant, you join a company and then it's like, okay, here's access to the data, 16 million tables, good luck. You're kind of off to the races. And everyone, like, I remember that there was this period of time where everyone would just have their own little weird heuristic. So like, you scan all the tables and you try to match on the names, and then you would do fuzzy search matching on the names to see if there was a typo or something like that. And you would cross-reference that by the time. But there were always these super duper hacky scripts. but it was also because I think back when I was doing this, must have been like 2016 or something like that, this wasn't a field. Like, it really felt like people, of course, did data mining and stuff, but it didn't feel like table representation learning was sort of a thing yet. But okay, we're talking about the field. And if you want to do anything in the field, you need benchmarks. And if you want to do benchmarks, you also need data sets. And I can imagine you alluded to that already. You need a starting point. And I believe you've been involved with two projects in that sense. One of them is called Schema Pile, which, again, good name. And the other one is called Git Tables. And my impression is, and feel free to elaborate on this, that this was basically an attempt by you and your colleagues to just have a starting point with lots of tables, and we can use this to perform our first benchmarks, kind of thing. But I also hear you say that, oh, but these are from the internet, therefore they have flaws. Like, is this still the feeling that you've got, or like how curious how this whole thing got started?
Yeah, so it actually started from the observation that, because by then, and that's probably good to point out, by then we had some representation learning models already that were adjusted towards tables, mm-hmm. but all tables from Wikipedia, for example. Right. So tables from the web, as in web pages. And mm-hmm. those are super small. They are like...
They fit on the browser, therefore they are not necessarily gigabytes big. Yeah,
exactly. So these are like tiny tables, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, where I was coming from, more industry oriented, I realized like, hey, this is really different from the data that I was working with. So that kind of started up the question like, how and where do we find data that is mm-hmm. actually more representative? And then I just started thinking for about a week, purely just thinking what potential data sources would be. Because you can also imagine that companies aren't particularly eager to share their data, right?
Here's all my sales data.
Exactly. That will never happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's probably, they're probably not going to advise that. Yeah.
No. So I started, okay, but hey, I've been a data scientist, and sometimes, although it wasn't intended to do that, but sometimes we used to share some CSV files along with some machine learning pipeline, for example, through GitHub, or at least some Git repository. Mm-hmm. So that's where I thought, oh, maybe GitHub would actually be a good data source for such CSV files that people in practice are actually working with. So then I went to GitHub, I typed in like ID, because many of these kind of database-like tables, they have IDs in them.
Like an ID column, you mean? Or
exactly, like yeah. Identifiers to identify unique rows or entities. Unlike Wikipedia doesn't have IDs, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, you know, semantic, like different semantic data distribution. And then I found already for this ID keyword and the CSV file format, I found roughly 16 million CSV files. So it's like a gold mine of tabular data. So that's why I started, okay, you know, maybe we can get all those CSV files out of GitHub. It was pretty ambitious because this is not really possible through all kinds of like rate limiting. And at some point, Microsoft took over GitHub, I believe, and then they kind of constrained this even more. So I think now it's even harder to get like to do data extraction from GitHub. But that was the starting point. And then we had like a data set of CSV files. And indeed, they were super messy. And this has been helpful, I think, for someone who has built a benchmark for CSV parsers. Because yeah, as we discussed earlier, it's pretty hard to parse CSV sometimes.
You cannot assume that pd.read_csv will work on every CSV out there. It's just not going to happen.
Exactly. It's not going to happen. So I think that collection is pretty useful, but I was interested in really the tables and kind of capturing the semantics. So
yeah, and I can also imagine like you would hope that at some point, like if we go back to the embedding thing, you would hope that there will be clusters in these embeddings, and maybe one cluster would be table without the ID, and they would be hopefully somewhat separate from tables with the ID. Hindsight would have to confirm this, of course, but like things like that, you do hope to be able to represent, I guess.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because recently I started wondering, like, what do we want these embeddings actually to capture? And you know, if we envision that task, then yeah, if we train it specifically for that task or, you know, related tasks, then that might actually reflect in those embeddings. But mm-hmm. I think, and there has been some research on it, I believe, but maybe we're asking a bit too much from these embeddings. I mean,
yeah.
So I think that's an interesting thing that I need to think about also going forward. What do we want really?
It's a really good point. Like, and the same thing, to be honest, in NLP, I've gotten very much the same vibe as well. So for example, if I have the sentence, I like Python, and the sentence, I don't like Python, are those two sentences similar? Well, depends on the task, really. But if you're trading in general embedding, this really matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because negation, is that the opposite meaning, or is it something else? And you will never get a perfect embedding because you need some sort of labels toward a task. And this is also why there are many different embeddings for many different tasks. I can totally imagine that you would have the same problem in Tabular land.
Absolutely.
In total sense.
Besides that, I've recently also started, you know, given that I'm now working on like dataset search and like retrieval, augmented generation over structured data, you know, there are so many things that you can actually put into this embedding if you consider the tabular domain. So you have, for example, metadata, you have headers, you have, you know, rows that you can feed into it. And then depending on what input data, let's say you have and what task you are doing, you know, there's no free lunch into, you know, what model actually fits that. So it's really like this mix and match, and you need to get a very good perspective on all the variables in that. So that's actually what I'm currently working on. So besides Git tables, there was like building a good data set to be able to learn large scale models over tabular data. That was the vision for that. I'm now building a benchmark for retrieval augmented generation over structured data because, you know, yeah, just because what I was just saying, that there are so many variables in these pipelines. But it would be so cool if you could just ask a question to some system, and then that system, and this might be the whole agentic vision, right? Mm-hmm. Where that system just decides, hey, you need that data set from these 60 million tables that you have, you need this specific data set to answer the question. You know, basically connecting the retriever to like analysis pipelines, I think would be super cool. So.
Yeah, and also, if only for the feature engineering of it, because I can imagine lots of these use cases, and again, the carts example is just stuck in my mind for this one. Actually, the carts example might be an interesting one to drill down on, just as an example. I can definitely imagine a system that would have been able to tell me, oh, by the way, here's just these related tables. Maybe just check them out briefly. That could have been immensely helpful, and it's like a needle in a haystack thing. So, you know, definitely makes sense. Part of me does wonder, though, like, there's still the domain knowledge of the company that's also required, maybe. It feels like that's still a big, big puzzle piece in all of this, right? So does that also make the application kind of hard? That in the end, tables are still just numbers in a file, but the whole meaning around it, like you still need the domain person around. How do you encode that? Is it like also something that you think about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, so there is this kind of, probably or maybe there are some general knowledge about a company that you can give as context, mm-hmm. But this might not always be available. And then you might have some metadata or context about your table. So that's also something that we're trying to experiment with. Like how much does this context data influence the retrieval performance, for example? Because so far, you know, the retrieval performance drops a lot, you know, from the first experiments that we've been running mm-hmm. or given approaches. So you can think of TF-IDF and like BM25. They are more reliant on this kind of context. But definitely all this domain knowledge definitely helps, I think. But I mean, we're currently not really incorporating or I haven't looked into, you know, incorporating very generic context because that might be constant for every use case.
Like this is the puzzle piece that will be different for every single company. That's also what makes it hard, I think. And maybe you're lucky and someone has written a paragraph about each table, like maybe there's a manual or something like that. And then maybe that, if every company just had that, that might be something that's generic.
Yes, that's definitely, any kind of table-specific context that is available and column-specific context, for example. So column descriptions or column types, all that is definitely feeding into these RAG pipelines or dataset search systems. Yeah, it's super helpful. You see the performance bump up with 0.4 F1, for example, with and without context.
Yeah, okay. Oh, a bit of a hunch there. Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, like, Part of this also reminds me of, if I think about the effort of also just what is the right data set? Like that's usually like a very tricky thing. And I'm reminded of, this is run, I opened it up on the screen here. Like, so there's a research paper, a large scale study about quality and reproducibility of Jupyter notebooks. So this is people saying like, hey, can we reproduce a Jupyter notebook? And the only question they tried answering is, does the notebook actually run? So they scraped all the GitHub, similar to what you did. It was also back in the era when that was possible. And they found out that 24% of all the notebooks were able to run, and only 4% of all the notebooks actually had the same result as the original notebook.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the reason why I bring this up is because I'm also wondering, do those notebooks perhaps add context here? Because I can definitely imagine if someone has done sort of an analysis on a table, let's say, and has like comments and all like good markdown stuff, like could that also be a piece of the puzzle here? I don't know if you're looking at that. I'm wondering.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I think any form of usage, however that is, you know, these might be previous like search queries, these might be comments, any such kind of
interactions, yeah. Kind of, yeah.
I think definitely help contextualizing these embeddings. If we can do that, then we can also, for example, you know, especially prior queries or prior pipelines, ML pipelines.
Oh,
then
yeah.
You can, if you then have a task-driven search system, for example, back to the dataset search problem, if you then say, hey, I want to build a model for ML term prediction, then if you have embedded that context, you can like separate this table that has been used for that specific task from that very similar table, but which has never been used for that task. So I think it would be super helpful to do that. But then the question is, okay, where do we find that? Well, I haven't been like scraping these Jupyter notebooks. So I don't.
Yeah, but I can also imagine that's like a whole, like, as I just mentioned, like half of those notebooks fail. And do you want to keep those? And the compute needed?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's also.
But what I think is an interesting source as well is Kaggle. So we're now constructing a data set with machine learning focused like task descriptions. As well as the data sets that have been used to implement those tasks. So I think that will be a super interesting source to, you know, also help data set discovery. And, you know, we might be able to, I don't know, do other kinds of stuff with that too.
It's interesting because I do find data set search on Kaggle to be somewhat hard sometimes. Like it's, I'm like video game data. I just want to type in video game data. But if you want to find the World of Warcraft dataset, you still have to type in World of Warcraft. It is still stuff like that I would just love to be easier because it does feel like there are so many fun datasets to like spend an afternoon and a weekend like doing some fun coding with. But finding the dataset is definitely still the hard bit there.
Yeah, absolutely. I fully agree, and I don't really understand why there hasn't been more progress in that direction because now, I've been around in a data management community for quite some time. Mm-hmm. They are all focused on join discovery and union discovery. And I think that's a super interesting problem to focus on. But in my experience, the problem starts with finding this one specific data set to start with.
In the first place, yeah. You can't find a data set, it's going to be hard to join on it.
Exactly. So <yeah. laughs> I understand that it's super cool to focus on join and union discovery, but we really shouldn't be kind of forget about the initial problem of finding a data set in the first place. We're looking into the Kaggle interface as a baseline. You know, how do these things compare?
Yeah, and I hammer on the nail on that one because you do see some data sets on Kaggle sometimes where there's like multiple CSV files, let's say, but it's maybe 10 and they can be joined kind of. But 10 is nothing compared to like what you see at these data warehouses. A totally different ballgame.
Yeah, that's another. So I think Kaggle is already a good test data set because at least you have like ML pipelines that use multiple CSV files and you have that information publicly available to you because previous and I think all like data set search interfaces expect that you are looking for just one data set. So now that we are moving towards task driven data set search, we want to be able to have like a specification of your task or machine learning task, for example, and then retrieve multiple tables instead of just one.
Mm.
So, and I think that will be a super interesting new problem actually to explore, and will be super helpful because then you don't even need the whole join discovery anymore because you already have the 10 tables or...
Yeah, and that can be done manually at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you don't, I think it's an interesting problem to work on. Yeah.
The one thing I kind of wonder, but I'll take a step back because you were talking about some stuff that I did and might help to add a little bit of context. Like in my spare time, I've made a search engine for archive where the whole point is that it's not just a search bar, but as you find articles while you're searching, you can say, oh, that article is a good example. This one is a bad example, et cetera, et cetera. But my main interest in that work, and this is also partially why I'm interested in your work, is that I'm interested in finding archive articles about datasets. Because I think it's very interesting when a research group takes the effort to produce a new dataset for the community. Usually it comes with some sort of novel task because they actually had to go through the effort of building a dataset, let's say. But one theme that I've been noticing recently, like my little scraper bot definitely still works, but I think like 70% of all datasets now are synthetic. Like it feels like they are generated either by ChatGPT or something along those lines, basically. Is that a theme you've also noticed? Because one thing I'm wondering about in terms of applications here is, can we do something with representation learning such that we can say like, oh yeah, but this is artificial, like this is simulated?
Oh, that's an interesting observation, which is kind of different from what I was used to, because you know, given the privacy sensitivity of tabular data, mm-hmm. often coming from, you know, organizations that are, you know, keeping their tables in, I'm very much used to seeing synthetic data sets.
Right.
There's actually a company dedicated to generating tabular data for, you know, various use cases. So I'm not too surprised by that. Although I would have expected the other way around, but now that we have indeed ChatGPT, and I must say that, you know, ChatGPT can generate more realistic data than, you know, the previous
generation of things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's definitely
it's
true.
Fair, but I think it's also good, and I would love to actually get my hands dirty with actual, like, real world tables in, you know, in these data warehouses, and to really analyze them. Like, what are the patterns that we see? What are the kind of deviations? Because I think, yeah, that would be interesting to learn from and make systems way more robust. But yeah, I think it's just easy, right? So everyone is in research. There is such a competitive race going on that people don't have or take the time anymore to like invest time in building a data set, because before you know it, there is this other lab who has been also building that data set, and that might be the common benchmark. So there's so much pressure on people now that maybe, you know, you see many people go for low hanging fruit in terms of like systems and applications of generative AI, but also on the data sets and benchmarking space.
Right. Yeah. I can definitely imagine it's still a publish or perish kind of an ecosystem, unfortunately. That is still a theme, I guess.
Yeah. But now with ChatGPT and, well, GPT in general, I think, it's just wild to see what's going on, and the amount of investment in this area, also in this research area, is making people go nuts, I think.
Yeah, going bananas would also be a way to describe it. Like, there's lots of ways to do it, but it's definitely different. Let me put it that way.
Hmm.
So we're getting a little bit closer to time. There's like two things I'm definitely still kind of interested in. So, To make the ball round first, like you've started, you've done your master's, you've been exposed to industry, and that has kind of helped you, I guess, in your academic journey. Like you were able to ask better questions, and definitely the insight of like, hey, the tables in industry are just different, dudes. Like, like this is not, take a step back and we need to rethink this. Like I can definitely see that vibe, and that definitely helps. But you're now a little bit closer to the end of your PhD. And then it's also like a good time to reflect kind of on, hey, where might this field kind of go? And what are the things that are kind of interesting to look forward to? Any thoughts or reflections on that? I'm just kind of curious.
Oh, absolutely. Lots of reflection on that. So I'm actually already done with my PhD. So I'm
okay. Now, I didn't know for sure. Like, I knew you were at the end of it. I just didn't know it was done yet.
But yeah,
okay.
Good clarification. Yeah. No, so now I'm officially a doctor, but that doesn't really matter. I think, I'm super happy to stay in academia. Mm-hmm. So I will start my own lab actually at CWI within the Database Architectures Group in Amsterdam.
Congratulations, by the way. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. So I received this huge grant from the Dutch government to fund lots of PhDs to mm-hmm. drive this research and expand on it. So there's so much interest in this, and it's a pretty new area. So there's so much to do still. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited, and I think across a few different directions. So one is, okay, how can we build like benchmarks? So for example, for retrieval augmented generation over structured data, how can we do that kind of analysis, but also to inform models for the future? So how can we think of our novel architectures and, for example, tokenizers for tabular data? Because lots of this kind of data is, for example, numeric, and these tokenizers are all like pre-trained on language and text. So, you know, what should we be doing more on the fundamental side? I mean, mm-hmm. and that's really on the part of more foundation models for structured data that I'm working on, and that will be one direction. And another direction is, okay, how can we build actual like tools more end to end? So now there's a lot of research in like agentic systems. So that is one direction. So how can we build, I don't know, different agents or whatever, different functions or something.
Or tools. Something you might be able to pip install, let's say. Like some sort of thing that will actually help. Yeah.
A wrapper around different tools that all perform a specific task. But I'm not so interested in abstracting humans away entirely. I'm mm-hmm. also not necessarily interested in like human in the loop kind of things, because then you typically think about like data annotation or something, or kind of giving feedback. But I'm really curious in kind of like human in the lead, let's say, where you just really start with, hey, what do you want to do? And give them charge of their process. So that's something
I like that I've never heard that phrasing before, but I do like the distinction, because it says something more about, it's a different kind of tool when you say lead. There's a subtlety there.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
so it's a nice phrasing.
I'm just thinking about this, actually. I've never seen it before either, so let me know. Like,
claim it.
Memorizing this, but I think human in the lead is just more, it's nice to think about yourself as being in the lead. And it's a different perspective on, you know, as a human, what we think. So as a data scientist, you know, being a data scientist in the loop definitely sounds less fun than being a data scientist in the lead, for example. So how does that change our mindset? Mm. And how can we just make it easier? So I'm really focusing on these kind of tedious tasks. So data set search, data cleaning, data validation, data, you know, preparation, whatever, merging different tables and so on. But also in, of course, the end-to-end stuff. So building machine learning pipelines, getting insights from data, of course. You know, we don't have endless numbers of data scientists to do that for us. So I'm really focused on kind of domains where there's not so much, like, financial investment to just spin up like huge data science teams. Mm-hmm. And how can we help them to still get insights from structured data? That's the kind of general theme of the work that I'll be doing. That's more downstream. That's all applications and fundamental on like, how do we improve these models for structured data and how do we train them? And then there's also upstream applications. So building more efficient systems. So then you can think of, you know, query optimization, but also compression, for example. And that will be, you know, other directions to explore.
So kind of in the domain of, oh, it's a string, but it's actually a categorical, like a little bit in that domain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's another direction that I'll be exploring going forward.
So I guess like a question that might be fun to end with, because when I look at so many data science tutorials, and Kaggle in a way as well, there seems to be so much focus on, here's a data set, do your ML thing on that one data set. And it makes sense. Like from a teaching perspective, this definitely feels like an okay step one. But step two in reality is, oh, but there are definitely more tables. And if people are sort of taking a step back and thinking like, oh yeah, this sounds interesting, I should probably dive into this a bit more. Like any tips and tricks or things that people might do to just expose themselves to this field a bit more? Because definitely the whole, oh, there's more than one data set. Like I do think that that's a very powerful idea that people should play more with. But at the same time, it also kind of feels like, okay, where do you start? You have any advice?
As a practitioner, you mean, or as a researcher?
I suppose both, but primarily, I'm not a researcher, so I'm coming at this from the practitioner. But if you have any advice on researchers, that'd be great too.
Yeah, so on the practitioner side, that's a very good question, actually. I haven't been thinking about how to make this actually happen or kind of, you know, build tools that close this gap a little bit. I think what you're doing, actually, I'm not sure if that's like a probable thing or at least what Gael is doing with this scrub, you know.
Scrub is part of the probable effort. Like we don't have a team on that project, let's say, but we do have like multiple maintainers eyeballing that thing. And Gael on scrub, definitely Gael is working on scrub. That's definitely, yes.
Yes, I think there, you know, if you can connect or whatever ML tool, if you can connect that with the data sources that the underlying data of these pipelines coming from, if you can connect that somehow with some retrieval method that says, hey, you're building this pipeline for this task, but we see that there's this unexplored, you know, data set here that is relevant to your task, you know, prompting people with that, I think would be super interesting to do.
Okay, so focusing a little bit more on the upstream retrieval of your data, try to spend some more time on that, and also think, because scrub features this joiner that's like a pre-processing step that people might be able to use, like thinking a little bit more about those kinds of pipelines, that might be a direction.
Yeah, but then I think that assumes already that you know the tables.
Yep. Right? And the current tools do, that's true.
Yeah, and I truly, now that we're discussing this actually and through the course of this this discussion, I realized that, you know, data search isn't really only happening and relevant at the start. It will, you know, someone has built, perhaps with years of experience, they will have built a machine learning pipeline, but they might not have been aware of this data set that would have been super helpful and have been, you know, would have helped them gain that 10% extra accuracy.
Like the cards table, just to name one example.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, at any stage of a machine learning pipeline processing, you know, getting good recommendations, whether that's on relevant data sets or relevant models or relevant, you know, data preparation steps, if we can get such recommendations, I think that would be super helpful to incorporate in these tools. So really building more like proactive tools, I think, will be super interesting.
Sure. No, but the one of the things I do seem to be hearing is that some of the tools haven't been built yet.
Yeah.
So if people want to dabble around, this would be a place to start. Like, think about, like, just dabble with the tool that you're building yourself and see how far you can get. Because it does, I think that is the right conclusion, maybe. There's still a lot more, this field is still new. So there's obviously still a lot of work to be done.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's.
So there is this term of dark data.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a data warehouse, and I think 90% of the data in that data warehouse is never used, but is actually useful, perhaps, you know, potentially. So being more or developing tools that explore that unused space and unused data sets and so on, I think would be super helpful. Yeah,
I could definitely imagine like, hey, there's a few tables that we never ever use in our team, but we do write to those tables. Should we maybe do something with that? Like kind of ask those sorts of questions as you're dabbling around.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. I think that would be an interesting tool to build or explore. But generally also in data preparation, so you can use these kind of ChatGPT-like models to recommend, you know, additional preparation steps, right? So So there is a lot of room there for you know, tool improvements as well.
Interesting. And then as a final question, because you were talking about, there's a distinction between the practitioner and the researcher, I heard you say. So, okay, same question. Now for the researcher, what would you say to the researcher?
From a research perspective, I think we should really, you know, make these connections with industry and really understand what people are doing in practice.
Yeah, because you're afraid of the disconnect is what I'm hearing a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm also hosting these table representation learning workshops at NeurIPS. And this year we'll have finally a more industry-focused audience that we try to target to really like inform us on the hard challenges and the important like needs basically in industry. Because I think it's super important that researchers don't make it easy and just focus on this kind of toy data set, but really start focusing on like what are the real world like data sets looking like, what are the real tasks that people are doing, and how can we like build tools that, you know, face that.
Yeah. How can we prevent that we all overfit on the Titanic data set, but then for this new realm, so to say?
And I think generally, you know, I definitely hope, and I've seen more research in this area, but I definitely hope it will get more and more, and that people really start to understand that like tabular data is really a separate modality, that it's not just, you know, text. You cannot just take a language model. You can get somewhere, but there are so many like specific challenges to it, and I definitely hope that people will kind of acknowledge that and start more exploring what are these specific, you know, needs for structured data, what are the specific applications, and we're so, you know, early in that stage. So I'm really excited of what is, you know, in the future.
I mean, especially when you consider that an image can be part of a table. You just have a row with lots of image links, and you can have texts and et cetera. So if anything, this is a more general, therefore also more challenging problem.
Absolutely. And it's actually from a previous discussion that I had, that someone had put in the comments like, hey, I thought that we were, you know, that tables were just very easy. And now, you know, I hear that tables are, you know, one of the hardest modalities to work with. So I think that's super interesting insight indeed. And it's been long overlooked, the kind of fascinating use cases that people are doing over tables. So I'm super excited to also meet with the Tabular ML community. So, you know, coming from the use case of, you know, building classification and regression models, that's what was typically Tabular ML, right? So, you know, connecting these two different perspectives, more data management, data prep and so on, with this end-to-end Tabular ML kind of use case is super interesting.
Super cool.
Yeah.
I do want to, like, we are on time at this point, so we're going to have to call it quits on this one. But Madelon, if people feel inspired by hearing these stories, where could they maybe find you online?
I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn with Madelon Hulsebos.
Okay, there you go. So
you might have to. I also have a website, by the way, with very interesting like pointers to research. Also, madelonhulsebos.com.
Very good. I'm going to add a couple of the articles that we mentioned, as well as your homepage, to the episode show notes. Again, because we're at time, Madelon, thanks for joining us, and hopefully see you around the conferences where we can geek out some more about embeddings and tables. This is definitely interesting field, so I'm curious to see what will happen in the next few years.
Thanks so much, Vincent. It was nice chatting with you.
Likewise. Thanks for listening to this episode of Sample Space, and also thanks for making it to the end. As always, we are definitely eager to hear suggestions, especially if you have suggestions on people that we should interview on this podcast. We do our best to make sure that we represent not just folks from the open source community. We are also definitely interested in hearing some stories from practitioners. So do let us know if you have a suggestion. Having said that, once again, thanks for listening, and see you in the next episode.